So thanks everybody, and especially a special thanks to Federica and Philip for the efficiency and the usual competence provided in organizing also this event. Thank you very much on behalf of Critica Liberale as well. Talking about the economic structural reforms that are needed, the Economist article provided as background reading by Philip quoted Jean-Claude Juncker, the Prime Minister of Luxembourg in 2007, who said, "We all know what to do, but we don't know how to get re-elected once we have done it." Now, I don't know to what extent we still really know what has to be done in the global crisis from the economical point of view, because economists have a huge debate about this in these days. But that sentence could probably apply rather to the creation of a real European political system. The job of reforming the EU political system has primarily to cope with the big problem of legitimation. The legitimation of a European political power in the eyes of European citizens who are misled and cheated by populist politicians. I remember last year in the ELDR conference in Barcelona the supplication of an Irish minister back from the Irish referendum campaign who said everything but another European treaty referendum. Another way of expressing the same fatigue for discussions on the institutions and the political system is the usual refrain, let's turn to the real practical problems of our citizens rather than discussing Europe. The fact is, you can't really solve any practical problem at a European scale if you have not the means and if you don't agree first on who and how can face and tackle our practical problems. There is something right in the over-optimistic way Mark Leonard proposes his views of Europe, and that is that the story told by journalists and ordinary citizens and politicians is very different from the story historians can tell. Our problems today seem, from some points of view, intractable, but they are relatively minor if compared to the first steps in the integration process. These steps were made with a huge political effort, leading to the Schuman Declaration, to the coal and steel community, uniting France and Germany just 5 years after the horrors of World War II. That's as if it had happened, these things had happened in 2005. It was a long-sighted and enlightened view, but what helped its relative success was it was enforced under the constraint of the Cold War. And yet the most ambitious project, the European Defence Community, failed because France was not ready for a political union. Since then, we have been proceeding much more cautiously. In 1957, the magic formula that conciliated the different views of what Europe should be was finally found. And I quote from the preamble of the treaties, creating an ever closer union among the peoples of Europe. That part of the preamble has survived through all the successive versions of the European treaties because its ambiguity is emblematic of the unsolved problems we are still facing even after the Lisbon Treaty came into force. We are no longer under the obvious threats of the Cold War. The geopolitical constraints forcing our integration is apparently no longer there. And yet today's challenge is not less decisive and demanding than that of the early 50s. Europe is simply the only way for us to survive in a globalized world. And it is the only way for us to remain part of the history of the world, nothing less than that. The sooner Europeans realize that, the better, and it is already very, very late. The only alternative to a real European subjectivity in the international arena is for us to be confined to a role comparable to that of Belgium in the first half of the 20th century. A developed, civilized, rich country, very much respected worldwide, once the years of the worst horrors of Belgian colonization were over, but also so geographically irrelevant due to its size that it could be invaded twice in less than 30 years and become a battlefield when an overbearing neighbor decided so. It is true that no one is threatening us that way nowadays, but the weight of all the individual European nation states in a globalized world is very much comparable to that of little Belgium in the first half of the 20th century. Individually taken, no European nation state is able to defend its economic interests, its political role, and its cultural influence in the globalized world. The last mentioned factor, the cultural influence, is perhaps less obvious than the others. In a world where more and more global and universally binding decisions will be necessary in the next few years and decades, many, if not most, of the emerging big powers are much less inclined, to say the least, to cherish liberal democracy and human rights. Most of us underestimate how much and how deeply European liberalism has shaped in the end the face of our civilization, not only of Western Europe and North America, but through them of a great part of the world. After World War II, the Western world and Western Europe in particular have been almost synonymous for free and open society. We believe in the universalistic vocation of our political values, but many actors, many emerging actors of the globalized world do not. And the pitiful images of Abu Ghraib show that, at least at times, Americans are not always their most credible representatives. And anyway, with their own comparatively reduced power in a globalized world, they are no longer capable to act alone. And after an 8 years long night, some of them are now aware of this again. However, in relative decline, the weight of Europe in the globalized world could still be decisive. We are one of the most developed part of the world, the biggest and almost the richest market. Our common currency is second in importance only to the dollar. If we were considered a political entity, we would by far be the third biggest in the world after China and India. Our weakness today is mostly a political one and largely depends on the exorbitant surviving, weight of individual national sovereignties. They are becoming millstones around our necks. But a democratic political system needs a democratic legitimation. European institutions, in order to be recognized as democratically legitimated, should receive their legitimation primarily from European electors rather than primarily through state governments, at least for all those matters that require European policies and European decisions. Today, because of the persisting and still overwhelming role of state governments, there is some truth in the claims that more Europeanization leads to less, not more, democracy. The most important political decisions, especially in the area of international politics, are still merely national, or at best, coordinated decisions. But in general, and despite the expansion of the power of Parliament achieved by Lisbon, even the most important political decisions of the European Union itself are, in fact, the outcome of fatiguing discussions among state governments. Once they have reached a very difficult agreement, the only possibility for the European and state parliaments alike is either to accept the result or to take the risk to jeopardize any possible agreement by rejecting those results. But if amending a proposal is not possible, the entire process results in less, not more, democracy. Not to mention the usual habit of national governments to blame the EU for the unpopular decisions that they themselves unanimously have to take, but of which they are not willing also to take the responsibility. The only possible way out, not to be wiped out of the number of local, of global players in the global world, is to convince our fellow citizens that, one, we can survive in a global world only as Europeans. And two, we already have a very strong common civic, not national, not ethnic, not linguistic, but a very strong civic and constitutional identity as Europeans that is very well perceived by the rest of the world, even if it is not so much well perceived by ourselves. That requires not policies coordinated or common to state governments, but recognizable European policies. And Lisbon is not enough for that goal. No German or Italian foreign policy could exist. It's not a matter of how good or bad it would be. It could not exist if every single relevant decision required the agreement of the 16 German lender or of the 20 Italian regions with all their different geopolitical priorities, their different economic situation, their different political majorities. In my opinion, if a real European subjectivity is not possible with the agreement of what we could call Snowball Europe and the 27, not 7, dwarves, those willing should autonomously start to give birth to a merging of some of their existing state organs and act as a single subject both in the European and the international arenas, inviting the others to join if they want so. Nowadays, the alternative is not only a slow, progressive, and gracious decline that many Europeans would be ready to accept, but it is a collective, smooth, and unperceived euthanasia of Europe. Now, I'm a convinced advocate for the possible free choice of voluntary euthanasia on an individual basis, but I am an even more convinced opponent of a collective, unintentional one. Of course, this would imply a huge, difficult, and demanding opinion campaign, similar to that carried out in the 50s that led to the signing of the Coal and Steel Community Treaty and to the Treaties of Rome. A campaign involving the European society, the economy, culture, the media, and politics. And I would be very happy if our political family were able to lead this struggle and drag into it the other democratic European political families. It is high time for a renewed, frank European civic, not ethnic, not national patriotism. We can no longer afford treating our fellow citizens as small children for whom it is always advisable to hide the ugly truth. It is high time that the challenge to Europe issued by populist politicians is finally met. Thank you very much. Thank you.